Weather Brains.
You're listening to Weather Brains. This is the show all about weather, and we are officially known as Weather Geeks. This is James Spann, and with me on the show tonight, we have two fine gentlemen. I'd like to introduce J.B. Elliott. J.B., how are you?
I'm fine, and I meant to look up the word geek this week in the dictionary.
Are we going to do that again?
I think we went through this once, but...
We did.
Yes.
I've forgotten, so you might as well do it again. Brian Peters is the other voice. Brian, how are you?
I'm doing great, and if you are not familiar with the weather in the Southeast, it has been so daggum hot, and finally, after months, it seems like, or years, it seems like, we finally got a cold front, and temperatures actually got down into the 40s and 50s, and it's like we've all got renewed life all over again.
We are refreshed and renewed. JB, are you?
I am refreshed and renewed, and October, mid-October to mid-November is my favorite time of the year, always has been. I'm a little bit worried this year about the situation with the autumn color, since we had the severe drought and still have the severe drought. But yes, I am vigorous and renewed.
And for those of you that are listening for the first time, the three of us are based in the Southeast United States, where we have had an extreme drought and, quite frankly, still have one, and very hot summers. So we're just excited that things are changing. We should mention that a couple of regulars are off the show tonight. Kevin Selly, who is a television meteorologist in Dallas, is under the weather. I didn't know that a weatherman could be under the weather.
He called it the mother of all flus.
That sounds pretty bad.
Sure does.
So we hope Kevin gets better and he'll join us next week. And Bill Murray is traveling as usual. He's at some highfalutin function at the time we're recording this. So we'll have to hear what that highfalutin function. I can just see him. You know, they got the shrimp out there and this big buffet spread and all that. So I guess he'd rather eat than talk with us weather geeks, you know.
Why does he never gain weight?
I don't know, but notice his hair's falling out, kind of like me. So, you know, you can eat a lot and you don't gain weight, but your hair falls out. So it's the same type thing. We've got several things I wanted to talk about tonight. We've got a great Weather 101 with Professor Peters, and Bill Murray does have his This Week in Weather History. But I wanted to start with an interesting guest editorial that appeared in the latest bulletin of the American Meteorological Society about broadcast meteorologists and global warming. Have you guys seen this?
I haven't.
I just did.
And I really think, in a way, this is pointed at me. It was written by Bob Ryan. And Bob is with WRC Television in Washington, D.C. And let me just say, as a disclaimer here, that the company for which I work, All Britain Communications, does have a television station in Washington. Our company owns Channel 7, which is a competitor to Channel 4 up there, that where Bob works. And John Tui Morales from Miami, and he is the AMS Commissioner on Professional Affairs.
Wasn't Bob Ryan the meteorologist for the Today Show on NBC at times, one time?
Yes, he was the original weather guy on the Today Show. And he went to the local NBC O&O in Washington, and then Willard Scott came in.
Oh, yeah.
And took Bob's place.
I believe Bob was a redhead.
Yeah, and he's very good. I've seen Bob on the air. He knows what he's talking about. And, again, I respect him, and I don't know the other gentleman, but let me just kind of use a quote from this. And I do not want to turn Weather Brains into a, you know, global warming debate kind of thing, but whenever we do talk a bit this, I would love to have both sides represented, and we have tried to get both sides represented without much success. But anyway, the article here, this guest editorial, says, and I'll quote here, this is a quote: "Alarmingly, many weathercasters and certified broadcast meteorologists," and let me again say that I am a CBM, "dismiss, in most cases, without any solid scientific arguments, the conclusions of the National Research Council, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change," that's the IPCC, "and other peer-reviewed research. For example, a recent public claim is," quote, I do not know of a single TV meteorologist who buys into the man-made global warming hype, unquote. You guys know who wrote that, don't you?
Sounds like you.
I think that's posted in a blog that we're all familiar with.
Yep, that's I wrote that back in January, and the Drudge Report linked to that, and then that's when the world paid attention to it. And I still stand by the statement, but let me finish this editorial. Such posturing aside, sampling the many climate change websites may leave many of us who want to be objective communicators of weather and climate information confused, to say the least. How do we maintain our professional integrity while also exercising our rights to freely express our opinion on an issue that a recent Harris poll indicated is of great concern to the public in many countries? And it goes on and on here. This is on the AMS website. If you want to read this, go to forums and then station scientists. But basically what they try and say is that as I read their editorial, it's kind of long. I sense that these guys want me to toe the line and pretty much go with the AMS policy statement that this agrees with catastrophic man-made global warming. And I have investigated this, and there is no mandate within the AMS rules that members have to go along with policy statements. And I understand it to be that way, and I know it to be that way. But they're both fussing at me because I'm not toeing their line. And let me just say this. Everywhere I've ever had the chance to speak about this, and for whatever reason, because of the publicity I received in the weeks after that blog post, I've been invited to speak in many venues on this. For example, a recent big, well-known Rotary Club in my market that's been around for a long time. And the first thing I say, fellas, is you need to hear both sides of the story. If you hear me speak, you need to bring in somebody that believes in catastrophic man-made global warming. Listen to both arguments, and then you go make up your mind. But it just seems to me that these other guys don't want both sides of the story told. And that's the greatest concern of this whole thing. It goes back to the lady with the Weather Channel that, you know, hinted that anybody that doesn't agree with her should be, you know, stripped of the CBM and everything. So, you know, I just disagree with what they're trying to say. I don't understand why they're trying to squelch those of us that feel the way I do. I welcome both sides. I read both sides. And I don't understand why they want to shut us up. And with that, I'll stop before I get in trouble. Any thoughts, fellas?
I think you should hang in there and continue with the course you've taken. And I agree with you. I think global warming is going on right now, but the Earth has gone through a bunch of cycles in the millions of years it's been around.
See, Brian didn't like to get in trouble. Go ahead, Brian.
Well,
I mean, you steal Wi-Fi. Come on. I mean, step into the fray here.
It's all free.
Oh.
I was trying to finish reading beyond where you were, and, you know, there's some statements in there that are just absolutely infuriating. Because they make the statement in here. Let me see if I can find it real quick. Some of us may disagree with its exact wording, referring to the AMS statement on climate change, the weight of the scientific evidence behind the statement is very solid. I don't think that's true at all.
You know, what's funny. I think that if they were, let's say the AMS decides that you've got to agree with our policy statement. If you don't agree with our policy statement, you cannot be a member. I would suggest they'd lose 80% of operational meteorologists and probably more researchers than they think. I would be shocked if they ever did that. And that's the reason I haven't resigned from the AMS, is because you don't have to agree with this stuff.
Right. Well, there's another statement in there, James, and this one is a slap at you. It's a slap at me. It says, the expertise of scientists actively researching climate change is well beyond that of most professional meteorologists, some of whom may only have basic training in weather analysis and forecasting. Now, excuse me? That means you and I are so stupid we can't evaluate what they're saying and come up with an opinion as to whether we agree with what they're saying?
And something deep inside of me wants to say, and if they could get away with it, they say, and besides, these guys are in you know, rural states in the southeast United States, and they're ignorant hillbillies anyway. But they didn't say that. In their defense, they did not say that. But, yeah, it's very troubling.
This whole guest editorial is a lot like the Weather Channel's
Heidi Cullen. Yeah.
And her, you know, slap that if you don't agree with us, you need to be stripped of your CBM. And, you know, I've had a lot of problems with AMS personally myself over the years. I much enjoy the National Weather Association over the AMS. But, you know, this kind of stuff is once again, I mean, they're complaining in their guest editorial about unscientific opinion, and yet they come out with these kind of statements which are not based on any kind of scientific reasoning whatsoever. So, you know, I don't know.
And I always think of Dr. William Gray out at Fort Collins. He has a long, long track record. And if anybody can understand the science of global warming, surely he can.
Right. I mean, and they're basically, you know, this is a slap in the face to Dr. Gray, to most state climatologists, including the one in the state in which we're located here in Alabama. And it borders on arrogance to me. And again, I would love to have somebody representing that point of view on this show, and we can debate the science of the whole issue, and I would love to do that sometime. So maybe somebody's listening that would love to come on the show, and we won't be ugly to you. We'll just talk. So I just felt like I had to air that out, and there has been such a volume, I mean an overwhelming volume of peer-reviewed papers backing up my position here in the last 6 months, that I don't see why they came out with this. And, you know, what I think what I've said that makes so many people mad is that this whole thing has been corrupted by money, and quite frankly, it's been corrupted on both sides of the issue. There's so much money flowing into this. This is a great generator of wealth, whether you are on my side of the stick and your money comes from the oil companies, or whether you're on the other side and your money is this grant money. And what I tell these civic clubs wherever I speak, before you listen to anybody have an opinion on this, you need to, number one, to get a disclaimer of their financial interest in the matter. And for me, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if we have catastrophic man-made global warming. If we don't, I still get a paycheck. And that's a very interesting issue that everybody needs to ask when you start hearing somebody spouting off on this
and
stuff.
I'll start over. And in your case, we can all vouch that there's zero financial interest.
Yep. It just, in terms of, you know, my ability to make a living, and it doesn't matter. So, and I have been, you know, vilified by these people. And I just sensed that this editorial was another attack on me. And it just borders on the bizarre. So
does it mention you by name?
Well, no, but it mentions my quote.
It's a pretty direct quote, too. I mean,
yeah. In fact, if you go down to the bottom of the article, it's got my name. It says James Spann, quote from. Now, they've got climatebrains.com as the website, which is one of our weather company affiliated, you know, owned websites, which I guess it's over there. But anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out there.
I'll read it later.
Yeah. And we would welcome Bob Ryan or Mr. Morales to come on the show and air their side of the thing anytime. Our forum is your forum. And I never hear that invitation from the Heidi Cullens of the world. I wonder, fellas, how many times do you think I've been invited to be on that program?
Minus six.
Zero.
Yeah, zero.
So, anyway, we'll move along here. One of the things I did for this week, I went back and looked at a lot of our emails, and we get wonderful email from this big audience we developed over the years. This is Weather Brains number 80-something. I forget which episode this is, but I've tried to find some common threads among the email, and maybe I'll kind of throw this out to you guys, and we can see if we can get a couple of answers for you. One of the common questions I hear is, I'm in high school. I'm very interested in the science of meteorology. What do I need to do? Where do I need to go to school? And I thought we'd let Brian give a Florida State plug here. Brian, so go Seminoles.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting, James, that if you're interested in meteorology today, as opposed to when I got started 40 years ago, you have many, many more choices than I did, because back in the mid-60s, when I was headed for college, you know, there was Florida State, Penn State, OU, Texas A&M, Texas, Utah, maybe St. Louis. There really was just a handful. You didn't have a lot of choices. University of Miami. And so I was very fortunate because Florida State was a state school, so I was able to afford to go there and follow my interest in the weather. But nowadays, like even in the southeastern U.S., you know, we have Mississippi State with their program, which is both aimed for forecasting and for television or media meteorology. We've got the University of South Alabama and their environmental program. Florida State, of course, which has a very strong tropical bend. So if you're interested in tropical weather, so it's really nice today that students have a lot more choices. But one of the things that I try to tell students is to pay particular attention to your sciences and to get, you know, you don't have to get chemistry necessarily, but chemistry and physics and especially mathematics, because when I went to Florida State, you ended up getting practically a major in math to get the requirements for meteorology. And one other thing is to know your computer stuff too, because that helps a lot, because we do make a lot of use of computers in the field of meteorology.
Yep, that's a great answer, Brian. And let me say this, I am a guy that started off as an electrical engineering major, of all things. But I had this passion for weather. Nobody would ever tell me that meteorology was a viable career option back in the mid to late 70s when I was getting, you know, in my late teens. And so I started off as a double E major, and I, at the same time, was working at a radio station, which led to an offer from a television station to do weather. And before you know it, I was rolling into this broadcast weather career, and I was an engineering major. And I knew that I had to get formal education in meteorology. With engineering, you get all the math. In fact, tons of math. You get a lot of the basics that you need, but I will say that the Mississippi State program was kind of birthed about the time I needed it, because I couldn't afford to quit working so I could work and take the classes at the same time. In fact, Brian, you'll never believe who my proctor was for the exams. He's on this. I'll give you a hint. He's on this program.
Could it be the great J.B. Elliott?
Yep. Remember those days, J.B.?
Yes, I do. And by the way, you're breaking up a little bit. You know, I think both you and Brian, and maybe me. But yes, I remember those days. I sure do.
Yep. Well, it was, you know, for me, it was just a wonderful thing. And it was, you know, multiple years, a good bit of hard work. But there are just many options out there. So what I would advise, if you're in high school or even if you're in college now, want to change majors or get into a master's program somewhere, just do some research on the web. But Brian mentioned all of the major schools, and they're still wonderful. You look at the classics, and I guess, Brian, you got Florida State, Penn State, Texas A&M, Oklahoma. Wouldn't you say those are the cream of the crop?
I would say so, yeah. And University of Miami, I think, has always had a big meteorology department too.
How about yep. Oregon State? Don't they have meteorology?
I think they've got oceanography out there, and maybe meteorology too. But anyway, there's a lot of wonderful options. Another question I see that we get a lot of this is, I want to be a storm chaser. And Brian, I'll let you respond to that. There's multiple ways to answer this, but I think that's a dangerous question in itself. I think there's some notion that people have that you can go out there in the Great Plains and chase storms and make gobs of money and sell your videos and all that. But the truth is, it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. You know, you might get lucky if you got a really some great video and somebody might pay for it. But I don't know of anybody that's gotten rich off of that sort of thing. And there's a lot of great imagery out there on the web that you can go look at. But, you know, it really is extremely dangerous. And in my career in the Weather Service, I trained storm spotters in Tennessee and in Alabama. And in Alabama, a few over 6,000, something over 6,000 in about 10 years. And I try to tell them, you don't ever do storm chasing in the southeast, because we just got too many hills, too many trees, and it can be very dangerous. Even the storm chasers that know what they're doing out in the plains, where you've got great visibility, it's still an extremely dangerous thing to do. You don't take it lightly. It's not something you do as a casual pastime, you need to know a lot about storm structure so that you don't get yourself in the wrong position and end up becoming a storm statistic.
Yep, and tornadoes are very rare, especially the F4s and the F5s. I mean, you know, people just think there's constant action, and the truth is there's not. It's like in the weather forecasting business. Most of the time you're dealing with pretty benign weather. In fact, a large percentage of your career will be dealing with that. And what I try and steer people into is storm spotting. You need to be trained. I go to a Skywarn class, the basic and the advanced, and get your amateur radio license. That's the other thing I encourage them to do. I've had my license since I was 14 years old, and Brian has his, and that to this day is the primary method that is used to communicate back to the National Weather Service forecast offices during severe weather. So get some Skywarn training, get your ham license, and find a local organization that's doing that. The Weather Service can help you find the local amateur radio club in your area and get plugged in that way and just be a volunteer. I think the notion of making big bucks as a storm spotter is just crazy. Do you know of anybody making big bucks?
I do not. That's why I chase high pressure areas and drizzle.
you can be on JB's Drizzle Chasers.
Yeah, might mention James that people who are interested in storm spotting can usually get storm spotter training through their local National Weather Service office, which is often provided by their local emergency management agency. So if you're in a more rural area, for example, not, you know, a big population center, you might want to contact your local emergency, your county emergency management agency, and specifically the director, and find out when they're going to have something or if they have something. And we're talking, and James, I think you're thinking tornado spotting and severe storm spotting. But, you know, spotters are used for a lot of things, like out in the western states, a lot of snow reporting. And so there's more than just the severe weather angle if you're really interested in the weather.
And let me put in a plug for the amateur radio operators. Back in the 1950s, when I first got in the U.S. Weather Bureau, later the National Weather Service, no such thing as cell phones. In fact, telephones on the corner, telephone booths were not that plentiful back in the early 1950s. So amateur radio was the key, and it was a critically important key. We had a great cooperation from those guys back in those days, and they were a tremendous help in the super outbreak.
Yep, and that's how I got my start, JB. My real interest in weather was initiated by being a spotter working with amateur radio groups in the western part of Alabama. So it's a wonderful hobby and a wonderful opportunity. One more question before we go to Weather Brains 101 that I'm seeing a lot of. Many people that have written in have kind of wanted to start their own weather website. And, you know, weather on the web is a commodity. I mean, there are millions and millions and millions of weather websites, and, you know, it's all kind of boilerplate. You get the National Weather Service products, and it's kind of automated. But, JB, you are part of this team that writes for a blog, AlabamaWX.com, which has become one of the, in terms of traffic, one of the most viewed local weather blogs in the country. Well, what advice would you give somebody that wants to start a weather blog or a weather website? What do you do that's developed this big audience to get people coming back over and over and over again?
I wouldn't push it too much now because there are so many, and it does take a tremendous amount of time. Of course, the automated stuff where you automatically download stuff from the Weather Service comes automatically, but to get original material and keep it fresh takes a tremendous amount of time. I know on our weather blog, during severe weather, and especially during hurricane events, we often update that every 10 or 15 minutes at the most with fresh original material, not just cut and paste.
Yeah, and I think that's the mistake a lot of people make. Okay, you know, they're excited about weather, and the internet is this wide open space, and everybody can be a broadcaster, and I'm going to put a website out there. And they do that, and they start, you know, they'll write a couple of blog posts a day, and then it gets down to, you know, one every 3 days and then one a week. And if you're going to do that, it's a waste of time, just an absolute waste of time. For this Alabama WX blog, in which JB is involved and Brian, there's 8 writers. And we've got them all the way from research meteorologist Tim Coleman to these incredible gifted writers, Bill Murray and JB, and it takes time and effort and a lot of energy. And let me just say, don't waste your time. Wouldn't you agree, Brian?
Yeah, I agree, because if you're not doing the weather all the time, it's kind of a waste to just hit and miss.
Yep. So having said that, we're going to get into Weather Brains 101 with none other than our own Professor Peters.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
PW stands for precipitable water. This is a parameter that gives the amount of moisture in the troposphere. PW is determined by taking all the mass of water vapor in the troposphere and depositing it on the Earth's surface. The depth of moisture that would be on the Earth's surface is the PW value. The mass of water vapor is determined by the dew point of the air integrated through the troposphere. Higher dew points lead to higher PW values, especially if the relatively high dew points extend through a significant vertical depth. PW values of a half inch or less are considered very low moisture content, while values of 2 inches or more would qualify as very high moisture content. Precipitable water is significant in a number of ways. In severe storms, tropospheric moisture determines whether a supercell will be an HP, high precipitation, classic, or an LP, low precipitation. For flooding potential, cases where the PW value is 2 to 3 times more than the climatological values, flooding becomes more likely when a heavy precipitation event occurs. For lightning, a high CAPE environment with high PW values will lead to storms that produce an abundant amount of lightning. PW is also important to updraft velocity, hail formation, convective wind gusts, and winter weather. But PW values, like a lot of parameters in meteorology, should be used very carefully. For example, PW should not be used directly to forecast precipitation amounts because other factors such as storm motion, moisture convergence, aerial coverage, and the amount of lifting and instability release also determine precipitation amounts. Well, that's it for Weather Brains 101. If you have questions about weather terms you hear, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Now, you know, you learn a lot on this show, don't you, JB?
Sure do.
Now, I never knew until I heard that lightning was somewhat related to precipitable water values. I had no idea, Brian.
I did not either.
Learn something new every day.
Yep, that's it. And again, if there's a topic that you'd like for Professor Peters to cover, just send us the email to question@weatherbrains.com, and we'd love to hear from you, and we'll try and get to that subject. And also tonight we have Bill Murray, who's not with us live, but he's here in his heart, and he's got this week in weather history.
Let's take a look back at some interesting weather history for the week of September 18th through the 24th. Great Miami hurricane struck the city during the early morning hours on September 18, 1926. It was less than 4 hours' warning from the U.S. Weather Bureau in Washington. At the Weather Bureau office in Miami, winds were sustained at 123 miles an hour. That was for 5 minutes, and winds gusted to 138 miles an hour before the anemometer blew away. It took 40 minutes for the eye to pass over Miami, and during that time, terrified residents fled Miami Beach across the causeway in their cars as the calm passed over, despite frantic warnings from the local Weather Bureau chief that that was not a very good idea. A total of 243 people died in the hurricane. Damage today from the same storm would be a staggering $80 billion. And it was the Long Island Express striking New England without warning on September 21st, 1938. The storm was thought to be headed out to sea when it caught everyone by surprise. Downtown Providence, Rhode Island was flooded, and the damage on the coast of Rhode Island and southern Massachusetts was incredible. A total of 600 people died. And on September 28, 1989, Hurricane Hugo became the first Category 4 or 5 hurricane to strike the U.S. since 1969, when it made landfall on the South Carolina coast with top winds of 138 miles an hour. The storm surge from Hugo reached 20 feet. $10 billion in damage made Hugo the costliest hurricane in the U.S., and that would last until Hurricane Andrew in 1992. And on September 21st, 1995, millions of trees were damaged when up to 8 inches of heavy wet snow fell on Denver while the trees were still in full leaf. Up to 80% of the city's trees were damaged. And finally, on September 22nd, 2005, Millions of people were getting out of harm's way as Category 5 Hurricane Rita advanced toward the coastline of Texas and Louisiana. Traffic was gridlocked out of Houston, and the storm eventually made landfall on the Louisiana-Texas border. That's this week in weather history.
Thanks to Bill Murray for that. And, you know, really we haven't talked much about current weather. Listening to Bill talk about this week in weather history, boy, this is an active tropical time. We've got, as I do this update here Monday night during the show, a little swirl off the Florida coast. What do you fellas think is going to happen with that thing?
I'll pass to JB.
JB is our tropical expert, by the way.
I was about ready to pass to you guys, and I believe it'll come across, and maybe go across the Central Gulf. I know the Canadian model, as you pointed out this afternoon, has it coming into southeast by the weekend, but I tend to think it'll be a little bit further south.
Yeah, something tells me this thing's going to head toward South Padre.
Yeah.
If Kevin were here, I'll speak up for him. I know exactly what he'd say.
Galveston! Yep. Everything, any tropical system between here and the coast of Africa, he says it's going to Galveston. And, you know, he called Umberto. If you think about it, it came in pretty close to Galveston, didn't it?
Oh, yes. But if you had one south of the Cape Verde Islands, Kevin would say, Galveston.
Galveston, that's it.
You know, after James, after what happened with Umberto.
Go ahead, JB.
It's not tropical, but I'm excited about what's going on around the rest of the country. I noticed tonight that a freeze warning out for all of Maine except Kennebunkport in Portland and much of New Hampshire, and freeze warning for part of Vermont and eastern New York State, and even a freeze warning for several counties in northwest Arizona. So it's a sign of the change in season, and I get terribly excited. Even though I've been in weather longer than the apple.
Yep.
I still get excited this time of year.
Yeah, one of our I do the weather on about 2 dozen radio stations around the country. One of the markets we cover is in Arizona, including Flagstaff, and I have got them in the upper 30s for the first time this season this week. Isn't that exciting?
Sure is.
And we have severe thunderstorm watch in effect across parts of the north central U.S. They're across Minnesota, parts of Iowa, a little bit of South Dakota, southeastern South Dakota. So,
sure is.
Yeah, I think next week I want to get into you guys' gut feeling on what's going to happen here in coming weeks and months. I am not real big on seasonal outlooks, and you guys probably aren't either. But everybody has got a gut feeling about the fall and the winter season. Here in the southeast United States where we are, we have a tornado season in November and early December. And it will be interesting to hear you guys' thought on that. And also, we need to start maybe even thinking about the winter season coming up. You know, we've got the La Nina going on and the warm AMO phase. And a lot of people are asking, what kind of winter can we expect? So we better kick that around next time.
I've got a lot of those type questions lately. And something else I'm interested in, too. Everybody in the whole world knows we've had a major drought here in the southeast. And I am concerned about, did we get enough rain from Umberto? Is that the way you pronounce it?
Umberto.
Umberto to help the autumn foliage.
You know, Brian, I'm thankful the next one is called Jerry.
Yes. Isn't that going to be nice?
Jerry and Karen. I can pronounce those two names. That's really good. But listen, if you've got, hey, look, if you're a listener, you got some thoughts on the fall and the winter season coming up where you are, let us hear from you. It's question@weatherbrains.com, and we'll see if we can poll our panelists here and talk about it next week. Anything on your mind, let us know. Again, it's question@weatherbrains.com. For those of you new, we do this show once a week. We typically record on Monday night and post it late Monday night or by early Tuesday morning. So you can pick it up on iTunes or directly on the web. So that's it for this week's show. This has been show number 86. Can you guys believe that?
No.
86. When we get to show number 100, we got to have some special prizes to give away. Maybe JB can give away a box of cinnamon Pop-Tarts.
Maybe we could give away a date.
I'll eat them before I give them away.
Ryan?
We could give away a date with J.B. Elliott.
Wow, that would be awesome.
Now, we'd have to get Judy's approval.
Yeah, but we'll come up with something special for show number 100. That's coming up not that far away. But for now, that's going to wrap it up for this week. Thanks a lot for listening. For the Weather Brains crew, J.B. Elliott and Brian Peters, I'm James Spann. Thanks a lot for listening. Have a great week, and God bless.